So, for this evening's talk, I remembered just when I was thinking, what the heck am I going to talk about this evening, that somebody did send me an email asking for a subject, and they wanted me to talk more about one of the big problems which people have in today's world, which is addictions. And first of all, I would say I'm not a psychologist, and I don't really have money addictions, which I really sort of recognize. Maybe there are some which I'm in denial of, but, you know, maybe telling bad jokes, I'm addicted to bad jokes. But nevertheless, sometimes because you're not an expert, because you see things in a different way, you know, through meditation, then maybe you could add something extra, something different, another angle, you know, on a problem which many people experience in today's world, which is about, you know, addictions. And so that's why sometimes that I don't mind giving a talk about something which I know very little about, but nevertheless can still add a bit of extra insight so that it may be of help to people. And apparently some of the emails I get back, sometimes surprisingly, that, you know, you are of help. And there are some of those addictions, you know, can, by being looked at in a different way, be surpassed. So one way is to look at addictions through the lens of Buddhist attachment. You know, we're attached to many behaviors, many sort of responses, and many sort of activities. And it's that attachment, that grasping, that addiction to things, which is something, as a Buddhist monk and meditate, you know a lot about, and how we can let go of such things. And of course, one of those ways of overcoming some of those addictions, some of those attachments and graspings, I sort of started to learn when I was just a young lay Buddhist, you know, at university. There was many things which I did as a young man, well, I did because my friends did. And you never thought twice about going out getting drunk, or going out sort of doing what I thought was cool things. I never really smoked cigarettes, but I do remember the story of getting a pipe and putting tobacco in it because I thought that was a cool thing to do. You know, Albert Einstein had a pipe, and many other sort of intellectuals had pipes. I think even the Prime Minister of England at that time, Harold Wilson, he'd always appear on TV with a pipe. It was a sign of being intelligent and being cool. And even more than that, I remember seeing this advertisement on the TV. And I remember this, it was about, I remember this so well, I still remember the advertisement and the brand of tobacco, Saint Bruno tobacco. And in the advertisement on TV, an ordinary looking man was walking down an ordinary looking street. People weren't really paying much attention to him until he got out his pipe and put in Saint Bruno tobacco and lit it. And of course, the marketing campaign for St. Bruno tobacco, that the aroma from this tobacco was irresistible to beautiful women. Because, stupid advert. In the advert, this ordinary looking guy lit the pipe, and then, first of all, this beautiful young blonde just left the shop. I think it was maybe just a greengrocer's shop selling fruit and veg, and she followed him. Another one came out of the bank, another one came out of the newsagent, until after about four or five, no, maybe about only 1 or 2 minutes, had this whole line of the most beautiful, attractive women following this guy. because the aroma of some Bruno tobacco is irresistible. Now, I consider myself an intelligent young student, a scholar in Cambridge, but guess who brought some St. Bruno tobacco? I did. I got totally sucked in. And you know what I did? I went down one of the streets at Cambridge, and then I put it in a pipe, I lit it. No beautiful girls followed me. Only a dog. And I didn't check was male or female or not. So much. But that gives some idea of how we get sucked into doing what is supposed to be cool things. And are they really sort of cool? Sometimes we lose our intelligence when we follow other people. This is actually where we start many of the addictions from. And of course, you know, then we get to things like alcohol. And I remember just 14-year-old, breaking the law, pushing boundaries, going into a pub in Richmond by the Thames in the afternoon, hardly anyone was there, acting like a big guy and getting my first pint of beer, British beer. It tasted disgusting. It really tasted awful. But I could not admit that because it was the coolest thing to do. And after about 6 months, I started to enjoy it. It's really weird. I enjoyed it because I was told that it was delicious. It was totally peer pressure making it enjoyable for me. And of course, you know, then you started drinking with your friends. But then afterwards, you started to wonder, what am I doing this for? And there came the time, and it was one time, sometimes with any addictions, that what the Buddha said, with attachments, you see the delight in it, the joy in it, but you also see the danger in these things. And sometimes when we're just watching just how cool it is, how enjoyable it is, sometimes we forget just the dangers. And it was one day, and I don't mind saying this, that I was really stunned at how intelligent people at university can do these things. Every year we had scholars' dinner. Only about 10% of the college were the scholars. I was in that 10%, good university in the top 10%. So invited to a scholars' dinner, where we started off in the gallery, which was built by the famous architect Sir Christopher Wren, with a huge mahogany table. And there were butlers, this was really high class, butlers in coats and tails, serving the really best sherry. And with my friend, because I was at that time studying maths, I worked out that the butlers were going around the table in a clockwise direction. And if I went around the table in an anti-clockwise direction at the same speed, it would mean I'll get twice as much sherry as my friends. I thought that was very cool. But it wasn't at all. Because by the time we finished the sherry and we went to the dinner, 9-course meal. And by that time I wasn't quite sure what I was eating, but it was supposed to be the very best. And the butlers were hanging around you. You'd learn the butlers would always come on your right, never on the left. Every time your glass was like half empty, they'd always top it. It would never go below the half, and different wine with every course. 9 courses with different wines. And then we went to the pub to have a glass of beer before going to the common room to have another time. There was cigarettes, cigars, and 3 glasses of port, sherry, and Madeira, always filled up. And then came the big goblet. The big goblet was silver with jewels on the outside. It would be worth a fortune. It was an heirloom, I don't know how many hundreds of years old, and really quite big, probably the size of this bell upside down. And it was filled up, I think, with port, and it was passed around, and every student and professor, and there was at least one Nobel Prize winner there, a chemist, or they all had to drain the big goblet and afterwards say a college toast in Latin. And how crazy can you get? And everyone was into that. And I wondered afterwards, because actually I didn't really wonder afterwards, because I don't know how I got back to my room. But I did wake up in the morning with a big pile of vomit next to my pillow. It was disgusting. And I didn't realize how dangerous that was, because many people choke on their own vomit. And people were saying, oh, what a wonderful evening it was. But for me, it was just disgusting. And so some of those attachments, when you actually look at it, at least I was rebellious enough, making up my own mind, not following what other people do, and deciding, this doesn't make any sense to me. Even though all my peers, all the people, the teachers and lecturers, and they were all into this, I thought, I don't want to do this. And that was the last time I drank any alcohol after that big dinner. And you know, afterwards, once I decided to make up my own mind what I wanted to be attached to, what I didn't want to see the dangers in these things, I got this big boost of energy. You really felt alive. When I told a cousin, he said, ah, you won't last. And he bet me £1 sterling, which is a lot of money in those days for a student. He said, ah, you'll give up by 1 year. And of course, that's been, I don't know how many years is that now? That's about 50 years now. He still hasn't paid me the pound. Doesn't matter. But now what it was that you actually made your own decisions. And this was the first time when you actually you say no to something, you get a boost of energy. It's like you're in power over your lifestyle instead of just following everybody else. So when it comes to some of the attachments which people have, and they think it's so cool, go and take drugs, get high, go and get drunk, just go and, I don't know what other people do, you know, go and bet on the Melbourne Cup. It's crazy things to do. Why do people do that? I can't understand it myself, because I make up my own mind what I want to find my enjoyment in. And of course, you know, betting on cup races, you know, sometimes people even come and ask me, Ajahn Brahm, who's going to win the Melbourne Cup? Last week. And I said, you must know. I said, yeah, well, okay. A horse will win. That's not what we mean. But you know, sometimes it's amazing that sometimes I don't know what it is about monks and nuns, but sometimes there is something weird about us. It was that, okay, a couple of stories. Yeah, I like little stories and get off the addictions to something more interesting, like old jokes and stories. But there was this nun, quite a famous one. I can't tell you her name, but we got a picture of her up in our dhanasala. And that's the way we eat. But anyway, she was a meditation teacher years ago. Absolutely true story. She was teaching a retreat in England. And after the retreat was finished, she was going to Heathrow Airport, I think to either get to London or to Germany or to Australia. She had a monastery over in Germany. And she was taken to the airport by another woman I know very well. And she had to stop for lunch. Now, if any of you have been to a place like England, many of the places for lunch are also pubs. But they're okay for monks. You just go through the bar into the place where you have your lunch. So off she went, you know, with her attendant, into, you know, through the bar, into the restaurant, have a nice lunch before going to the airport. And, you know, because monks and nuns, we have to only eat one meal a day, we eat a bit more than lay people can eat later on. So, you know, she was still finishing off her lunch, and her attendant, her driver, had a few British coins left. And she did not want to, it wasn't worth exchanging them at the airport. It was not really enough. So she decided to get rid of the coins in one of these pokey machines. You know, this thing, you put the coin in and you pull the handle, and these little things go round, round, round. And if it all comes up the right way, then you win. And she was just getting rid of the coins. And she just put, well, a pound or 2 pound coin in the machine when the nun walked past. And she said, "Venerable, you have much better karma than I have. You pull the handle." And in that one moment, losing her mindfulness, the nun pulled the handle. And this is no exaggeration. Those wheels went round, round, round. Ding, 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 ding. It was a jackpot. She went, and all these coins, all this money went on the nun's robe. No, she's a very good nun. We're not supposed to accept money. We can't handle money. We're not supposed to touch it. And she got hundreds, thousands of pounds on a... And that wasn't the worst of it. Because as soon as they saw this nun winning the jackpot on the pokey machine, everyone else in the bar went quiet. And they went, "What the heck's going on?" And then the barman, he rang the bell. And he announced to this nun, it was the tradition in that pub, whoever wins a jackpot has to buy a free round of drinks to everybody in the bar. So the nun had to break another rule, serving alcohol to every patron of the bar. So please don't do that, Venerable Chanda. You get in big trouble that way. He would say, "Oh, well, you don't have to touch it. As soon as you pull the handle, get out of the way, we'll collect the money." But no. So sometimes, even like the gambling, sometimes becomes an addiction. Why? And again, it's the attachment. We always think we're going to win. But if everybody won, where would the casinos and the... You know, I almost went into a casino once. Just was with the press past president, Sol Hannah. Because there was some award ceremony in the Burswood Ballroom. And I haven't been there before. And Sol had never been there before. We didn't know which way to go. So we're walking around, getting totally lost. And then we go in some corridor somewhere. Where's the ballroom? No one will tell us. And we pass this place, this opening, and all these lights, flashing lights. I said, "Uh-oh, this is the casino." So straight away I said, "Let's get out quick before someone gets a photograph of Ajahn Brahm." And a then president of the Buddhist Society of West Australia in a casino. I get into some difficult situations sometimes as a monk. But just going off, I don't mind telling these stories. There we go. One of the most embarrassing ones, stories. I'm a good monk. You know, I don't sort of look for trouble, but sometimes trouble comes to me. This time, I was, in those days, you know, it was a very simple monastery, not many people, and I volunteered to teach in the prison at Bunbury. And when I was teaching in the prison in Bunbury, the only way to get down there simply was to take the Ossulin train down there, stay the afternoon, and then just do the teaching in the evening. But that particular day, you know, I had a free afternoon, so what to do? So I went down to the beach, Bunbury Beach. It was a huge beach. There was no one there. And so I sat down to meditate, closed my eyes, very peaceful, very comfortable, and for a couple of hours meditate by the beach. You know what happened? When I opened my eyes, there were some people on the beach. But even worse, next to me, on my left, on my right, were two 17-year-old girls in bikinis. If someone had taken a photograph, that would be the end of me. And I was like, well, what's going on? And what had happened, the reason I knew they were 17-year-old was because they were from Bunbury High School, which was just the other side of the road from the beach. It was November, probably. It was the last exams of the year. Was it TEE or whatever they called it then? TEE exams. They just finished their last exam. And so they were all changed into their bathers or bikinis and are out on the beach to celebrate, to relax at the end of their school year. End of school. They're going to go to university afterwards. And there they saw this bald-headed guy sitting really peacefully there. And they were very respectful. They just sat next to me waiting for me to come out of meditation so they could ask me questions about meditation and Buddhism. So, you know, they were totally, totally just good intentions. But how could I explain that? So I said very quickly, oh yeah, this is meditation, this is peace. I've got to go now, bye. I wasn't very kind of compassionate. Those are amazing little stories. Anyway, we're attachments, yes. So sometimes the attachments which we get, you know, we rely upon these things. Other people do it, that's where we get involved in it. Or we don't see the danger in it. Sometimes we don't really see it for ourselves. What are we doing that for? Even like sometimes people go on these, I can't understand it. I did go past once the adventure world in Bibra Lake. I'd never seen anyone do a bungee jump before. And I thought that's what they did to torture people, to get information out of them. You know, throw them out of a helicopter or something. But people actually paid for this. Why do people do that? You know, sometimes people look for their pleasure in life, their delight, in ways which is, if you look at it, is it really worth it? What are you getting out of this? Instant gratification, maybe, but a long-term problem and difficulty. So sometimes we look at a much bigger picture. And the trouble is, though, if you've got no other way of finding delight, finding meaning, finding fulfillment, sometimes people go to what's ever available. And for me anyway, I decided a long time earlier that as soon as I let go, gave up one thing, it gave me just so much joy. It was like I was in control of my life. What I can do, what I can't do. Instead of just being a victim of what other people are doing all the time. And so when I started doing that, what I was actually doing was finding the power of letting go. Letting go, making my own decision, what I wanted to do. And I would experiment with that. And adventurous enough, rebellious enough to say, well, I'm going to try doing something else. What you actually found that when you lived a more simple life, you didn't need so much of those attachments and those pleasures. You know, for 7 years I was in the jungle in Thailand, and people say, how could you live in a place like that? It was hot, there's no air conditioner, sleeping on the floor. And I often mention to you in the heat, I mention to the monks, and this is, again, I don't exaggerate this, sometimes the tarantulas would be crawling on the ceiling and sometimes they would drop on you as you were resting. You know, bare chest, and they would drop on your chest. Big, you know, this size, tarantulas. And when they did, I actually quite enjoyed them. They were sort of like tickly. They never bit you, they were just tickly. And we had all these wonderful stories living in the jungle, in the forest. Like that time when, I'd been meditating all night, and I went out, because in those days it was a big jungle, so, you know, you could go to the toilet if you wanted to, but often you just squat down and go in the bush. Actually, I did that today in monastery. But you always have to look around to make sure that no one finds you. It's much healthier, you know, just do a squat and just, you know, urinate there. The water actually goes into the bush instead of going into a septic system and wasting all the energies and stuff. So anyway, I like doing that. Anyway, it's just my old habits. So anyway, that morning, I was squatting down. It was first light. I was tired. And I really thought I was urinating on a stick. Now, first of all, remember, you're squatting down. And I thought it was a stick. Now, quite a thick stick. But then what happened? The stick started to move. It started to wiggle. It wasn't a stick. It was a snake. A venomous snake. And I had, what I don't mind saying, the most sensitive part of a male anatomy was only about that far from the snake's mouth. But did that snake bite me? No way. This was Thailand. The snakes in a monastery, they knew that they were being blessed with holy water from a good monk. And extra, it was warm. So that snake just stayed there and this was enjoying every moment of it. I wouldn't try that on a dugite in Australia, because they're probably not Buddhist. They just wouldn't understand. But, you know, sometimes, because you're living in such a simple life, I remember the first time when I left Thailand to go and visit my mother over in London. No, he was traveling economy, I think it was in Philippines Air, the cheapest flight I could find. Squashing economy. You know, that was luxury. I couldn't believe how comfortable the aircraft was. Number one, there was no mosquitoes, no snakes, not warm. And it was the first time I sat on an upholstered chair for 7 years. It was amazing. And it was hot food. They didn't serve frog on rice, no ant's eggs, no cow afterbirth, no rotten fish, which is, you know, what you survived on in those days in the jungles. And the amazing. And people around me were complaining. I couldn't understand it. What are you complaining about? This is luxury. Economy class in the cheapest airline we could find. So what is attachment anyway? What is our addiction? Sometimes it's just what we get used to. And sometimes I realize just how simple your life could be. And how you don't need such stuff. I don't know how many people just get addicted to the screen, TV, movies, the news, because we'd only get a newspaper, maybe, I know it's actually not a newspaper, Time magazine, maybe once a month or once every 6 weeks. You know, somebody came up and told me when I was there, they said, oh, there's the your country, UK, are having a war with Argentina. Come on, that's a joke, isn't it? People don't have wars anymore. It was a Falklands War. I didn't believe them at first. But then when I did see the news, a newspaper, you know, I found out the news was always the same. It was just a war here, a war there, corruption, sort of elections, people doing this and people doing that, fraud. It was the same news, only with different characters. So the one, you know, have you ever noticed that? Look at the news 5 years ago, 10 years ago. The same stuff they have in newspapers, only different actors, but the same play, the same script. Why are people so addicted to this? So sometimes I decided to go a different direction and not look at those things. And when I did see my first TV, it was just, after 7 years, it was just so harsh. The scenes were changing so quickly. I couldn't believe it. And I remember just being with my mother, and she was watching some half an hour show it was some detective show, and I was just counting how many people died in 25 minutes. It was about 20 or 25. And this was crazy. Because beforehand, when I saw violence on the TV, someone maybe my age may know the TV show was Dixon of Dock Green. And Dixon of Dock, you know this one. He was a British bobby, never carried any weapons at all. Whenever he arrested a thief, the thief would say, "You're arrested." And the thief would say, "It's an honor, sir, to be arrested by such a famous policeman as Dixon of Dock Green." It was crazy stuff. But anyway, there was no violence. And you can see that people get addicted to violence, fast scenes, things going really, really rapidly. And to me, having been in another place, getting a perspective, that was just so harsh. So sometimes, it's great when a person who has an addiction to modern life goes off to a monastery and has a retreat for a week or a couple of weeks. Even if you're a Christian, to the New Norcia monastery, and actually to see just another way of life, to get a perspective on just our addictions and attachments. You know what happens when people really do have time out? No internet, no Wi-Fi, just time out, just in nature. They have an alternative to the addictions of modern life. They find they don't need alcohol. Sometimes people, they look at monks and nuns, "You guys are happy. How come you're happy? How can you be happy without alcohol, without drugs?" Some people don't get it. They think that it's weird. Even once when I was visiting UK, it's a really inspiring event that I think the Thai community in UK, together with a couple of monks and some very, very good prisoners, we managed to get a Buddha statue, a big Buddha statue offered by the Thai community to go into one of the prisons. It was like a low security prison, but it was supposed to be a Buddha grove. So they put the Buddha statue there to give some peace, some forgiveness, some acceptance, some compassion for some of the people who were in that jail for, I don't know what they did, didn't really care. But it was a sense of something which was uplifting, peaceful, and it was amazing they managed to get the British government, the Home Office, to allow that in one of these jails. But anyway, when they put it in there, there was a big opening ceremony. So I went to that opening ceremony, and that sometimes we go do this circumambulation. We go round and round three times. It's not circumcision, so you don't have to worry about becoming a Buddhist. Three times around the Buddha statue. And I was doing that. I was getting so inspired, so happy, so joyful. This amazing thing. I knew this would create a good atmosphere, in this jail. And I was just really smiling. And there were the Thai community were offering really good dinner afterwards for all the prisoners. So most of the prisoners were there just waiting for the ceremonies to finish, to really pick out on beautiful, delicious Thai food, which they didn't usually get in their prison. But anyway, there's a couple of prisoners. I saw them as I was going around out of the corner of my eye, and they looked at me and saw my big smile. And I overheard them say, "See that monk pointing at me? He's on the gear." Which I later found out, actually I'm not quite sure, it's some drug anyway. But they thought I was taking drugs. That's the only way they could understand, a happiness and joy. And it's amazing that you can have happiness and joy without those attachments. And so that's one of the great things, the addiction which people have. There is an alternative. which is makes you happy and joyful. And when people actually see it, there is an alternative. You don't have to live a miserable life. You know, the word in Australia is being a wowser. You know, just having fun, that's really bad. You know, you monks, what on earth do you get up to over there? You know, you must live a terrible life. You can't do this, you can't do that. That's the meaning of none. None of this, none of that. Sorry about that. But to actually to see that you can have that joy and happiness without any of these dangerous stuff, which means that you have an alternative to the pleasures of our addictions. Because sometimes just giving something up without an alternative, what's the point? I miss my happiness, I miss my joy, I miss my excitement. And I don't mind saying, even like addiction some people have to sex or porn. And that's what some blew me away that one time. Just still a layperson, going to a retreat. I had a nice girlfriend. Left her for a few days while I went on this retreat. And getting into, so when you really let go, you let go of your attachments. You know, you do press the letting go button and just there and just, you get in such beautiful bliss states. And you know, you've heard me say this before, it was a bliss and ecstasy better than having sex with your girlfriend. Good sex. Some people say, Ajahn Brahm, you shouldn't say that. But I have to say that, just, you know, to show that, you know, this is real stuff. The joy of actually being free of attachments. And the difference between the joy and the happiness, which is not anything to do with attachments, is when it's attachment, it's like a dependent. You have to have that drug, that beer, that friends, that relationship, that sort of high. But when you have the joy of renunciation, of letting go, of peace, it's a joy which actually comes up not dependent upon anything. It's free. It's a joy of letting go. And when people say, oh, I jump on, you get attached to those happinesses. How can you be attached to letting go? It's one of those oxymorons. You either attach and stick to something or you let go and free. And then you have an amazing sort of happiness. And that's something which, again, it was a retreat which I was teaching. It was at a Christian place a long time ago. And during the interview time, I had just happened to, it was on a Sunday, I happened to look through the window. There's these two men, they'd just been to the church, I think it was a mass. And they were just, you know, two good friends, maybe in their 50s or 60s. Shaking hands, and as they parted, one said to the other, I overheard them, be good. And the other one said, no, that's no fun. And when I heard that, you know, my heart dropped. You have to be bad to have fun? And you know, it doesn't make any sense to me. Being a good person, being a good monk, you have a good time. Literally. There's something about our world. I challenge things. Look at it the other way. You know, see an example of people who just live a kind life. You get much more happiness, you know, serving other people. Ajahn Brahm, why do you have to come out Friday night to give a talk? Look, you got Venerable Chanda here, you got Ajahn Nisarana here, all these other monks. Why can't I invite them to give a talk? Because I'm selfish. I just like the fun of serving. The joy of actually, and you know, you get so much fun out of this. Sometimes when you get some people come up and they just give you a hug because you say, thank you for helping me, for saving my life sometimes. And that was one of the first times I heard that, I thought, wow, that's what I want to be attached to. Attached to the joy of serving and giving. You know, sometimes addiction. Yeah, I'm addicted to serving, giving, letting go, renouncing. Just see how simple I can make my life and how much it can help other people. That type of addiction is an alternative. Number one, you start to feel good about yourself. The old sense of self-worth, not being a victim of life, but also like being almost like being in control of life, making your own decisions, going against the stream. What do you want to be? And sometimes when you have that good feeling about yourself, because after a while you can't just avoid it. There's some really good people in this world, and I want to be one of them. So when you become one of those really good people, you don't need anything else in this world to support you. Alcohol, whatever. But anyway, if anyone does ever get invited, there's one fellow here some time ago, he said, you know, out there in the world it's so hard to avoid alcohol. He wants to be a good Buddhist. We keep 5 precepts, no alcohol. And he said, but, I went to a party. He said, in the office. And in the office party, the guy came around with the drink tray. He said, you know, have a drink, have a beer. And this guy said, no, you know, I'm a Buddhist. And these days people know enough about Buddhism in Australia. The host serving the beer said, oh, you're a Buddhist, amazing, yes, a great religion. It's all about letting go. Come on, let go, have a beer. That's what he said. So it did work. But you know what he said? It's great, I mean, think it out for yourself. Do something different. So he came up and he told me the problem. But then again, he said, no, you found another way. So the next time he went to an office party, you know, with the firm or the company, and they offered him a beer or a drink, he said, no, no, I can't take a beer. Doctor's orders. No one argues with you if you say doctor's orders. They accept that straight away. So, oh, I'm sorry about that, just we'll get you an orange juice or an apple juice or something. And when he came and told me that trick, I said, that's as bad as taking alcohol. You're lying. I know you. You're very healthy. You know. And he put me in my place. Ajahn Brahma expected better from you. Because, you know this. In the teachings of the Buddha, many times the Buddha compared himself to a doctor. He said it was a doctor's orders. Dr. Buddha's orders. Oh, fair enough, good one. Nice trick. But anyway, he felt more in control of his life. He decided what he was going to do, and he felt so much better for it. So sometimes, again, if you do, give up a little bit here, give up a little bit there. Give up, like, anger. Sometimes we get attached to being right. I'm saying this because we have partners. And I was just looking at this email from I did one celebrity wedding once over in KL, and it was in the Malaysian edition of Hello magazine. So I had my picture in Hello magazine because of a celebrity wedding. But anyway, this celebrity still keeps in touch, and she said to me that her husband said, you know, when we argue, it's like you don't love me at this time. And at that little point, when you argue, you don't love me, it reminded me of another saying. Why is it when we shout at somebody, why is it we shout at people we like and love? A lot of times, if you're shoved to shout, it means that emotionally, you're far apart. Which is why, if you're far apart from someone, if they're way over there in the park, you have to shout to get their attention. He said, psychologically you shout because you're far apart. Not physically, emotionally at that time. But when, you know, you are together, when you really love and respect each other, you don't shout, you whisper. The whispering means you are close together. You don't need to raise your voice. I thought that was a very lovely insight. So if you need to shout, it means you're distant. You can just need to whisper to one another. It means you're close. So sometimes a little thing like that saved a lot of problems. Why are we addicted to sort of finding fault with one another instead of giving people the benefit of the doubt?
and learning how to love one another and respect one another. We all make mistakes from time to time, except me. That was one of my mistakes, saying things like that. So we let ourselves make mistakes, and that means that we're not attached to being right. So often I tell all my stories of when I made mistakes. And I actually told this to some people today because their brother over in Wellington had a heart attack and is a bit on the edge, so hopefully he gets better. They asked me to do some chanting for him, which I will do. But then I said, what type of chanting? Because that story of this Chinese patriarch over in Walpurth Hospital, you know, it's one of my big mistakes. The family invited me into the ICU, he was in a coma, to do some chanting for him. I was a bit of a rush, so I did the chanting and it worked, he got better. At which point the whole family got very upset with me. They'd come from, I think, from Hong Kong, Taiwan, mainland China, come a long way, you know, for their relation. They'd already arranged a funeral service. And this monk comes up, smarty pants monk, comes up and does the chanting and gets better. And they said, now we've lost a lot of money. We're going to have to come back in 6 months when he dies properly. But because of that, you've lost us a lot. I didn't get any donation for that at all. And he said, we didn't want you to chant for him to get better. We wanted you to chant for a peaceful death. That's a big mistake of mine. Now these days, whenever that happens, I always ask people first of all.
What type of chanting do you want? Peaceful death or get better? So we all make mistakes. And when you tell people, that's a true story, that happened. When you tell people those mistakes, you know, people laugh, you know, you're human, no one always gets it right. And it means you don't have to be attached to being right. So if ever you do make a mistake, let people know. It's fun. It means you're human, no one's perfect. And what a wonderful world that is, when we can all be at the same level. We make mistakes, we try, do it wrong this way, and then see what happens next time. Okay, I've been talking too much already. It's 8:50. Are there any questions, comments, or complaints? Oh, you got a question, Peter. Very good.
It's just attached to talking to a particular person. And I can't, like, I speak to this person daily and I can't seem to sleep unless I speak to this person.
You can't sleep unless you speak to this person. So sometimes, what can you do? You can...
It's via mobile, Ajahn.
Sorry?
Via mobile, like a mobile phone.
Oh, just mobile phones, yeah.
Screen to screen.
Yeah, sometimes what you can do is sometimes if you go to a monastery or temple where there's no mobile phone, go in the bush. Go in a place where, you know, there's, I don't mean shepherd's bush, I mean a real bush where it's no sort of internet, and you find it's hard at first. And then you can't go to sleep, you miss someone, it's all that attachment to not missing out on things. But after a while you find, hey, I don't need to do this. You don't need to keep calling people up. The world doesn't stop. And that means after a while you get tired enough, you just go to sleep and you break that habit. And as long as you're in a supportive, safe place where you can just, you know, let go of those attachments, and after a while you find it wasn't much of an attachment anyway. So sometimes, if you want to, you give me your mobile phone and I'll delete their address. And then, what are you doing? And you find you still survive. Okay, anyway.
Can I?
Yeah, go on.
Ajahn Brahm.
Yeah.
You know, regarding attachment and addictions.
Yeah.
Yeah, from my understanding of the Buddha's teaching,
yeah,
we just can't come out of it, you know, because yeah, from this attachment and addictions, our mind has been conditioned to it, you know. the way to come out of it is to put another thought, you know, like to see the shortcomings and the problems of the attachment and the addictions.
Ah, you see. So if the Buddha will stop the microphone for you speaking too much. It's karma, Eddie. Okay, never mind. Anyway, it's true to actually have something else. And that something else was what we're talking about. Something which is more joyful and see the danger in things. Sometimes that's the escape. Very good. Okay. Now from the USA, Ireland, and oh my goodness. Das Crispy Squivel. I don't know where that is from. Anyway, from the USA, how does one work with addictions which are in the mind? How do you escape from the sufferings and discomfort that are in your mind? They are not in your mind, but it's like a rut, habit in the mind. So first of all, being with other people who give you some reflection, because as I said with that simile of the pipe of St. Bruno Tobacco, you know, I just got that from other people, you know, and I thought it was a cool thing to do. If you're with the wise people, then some of those addictions in the mind, you find that they're pretty easy to get out because you get them from others sometimes. They're not just in your mind from birth, you actually pick them up from other people. So sometimes that being around good people helps. And that's one of the reasons why when you have like things like AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, then a lot of time the peer, good peers, being around other supportive people, that sometimes helps. People who actually, basically the mind is plastic, as they say, can be reconditioned. And being with other good people can recondition that mind. From Ireland, dear Sir Ajahn Brown. Oh, that's very nice. I've been knighted. Please can you send some monks and nuns to Ireland as well as the UK? The young people here need help so much. Fair enough. So, to Ireland?
Next year,
Roger. Okay. Yeah, I did want to go to Ireland.
Yeah,
it's a very nice place. No, I kind of like...
Do you want
to? Yeah, go. Yeah. The young people here need help so much. Yeah, sure. Okay. So, I'll send some monks and nuns to Ireland, as well as the UK. Oh, they didn't invite me. They sent other monks there. Okay. Off you go. No, it's nothing. It's wonderful. Oh, yeah, I know, but they got the invitation here. We have a lot of the... people just travel around. There's some really nice Irish people have come here. Know to visit, and they've had a wonderful time here listening to the Dhammaloka Centre. This is a pretty special place. People come here, and there's nothing like it in places like Ireland. So, yeah, sure, why not? Anyway, this one, I don't know, Das Crispy Squivel. Okay. I'm addicted to anger. The origin is always the same, grief, but anger feels preferable to sadness. Yeah, sometimes people do. They feel alive when they're angry. They've got some cause to fight for. You know, when I was young, I remember going to protests, you know, for good causes. Now, some people were just really misbehaving in government or other areas. But then I saw that I was standing next to somebody and I saw their anger just... madness. And they were throwing things at the police and said, that's not going to help anybody. That's not the sort of protest I want to do. And just the anger becomes addictive and then you get whole groups, you know, the communal anger when that gets fed. And that anger gives you a high. People wouldn't get anger unless there was some pleasure in it. Let's get rid of the government! But the little anecdote which comes to mind was Monty Python's The Life of Brian. It was a great religious documentary, in my words. And I don't know if you've not seen it, but it's worth seeing. And in that documentary, they had this protest group, rebellious group, I think the PNNPPC or something, and then they were having a meeting. Because this was in Jerusalem during the Roman occupation. "What have the Romans ever done for us?" they shouted, really angrily. And someone put their hand up. "Well, you know, actually, they created roads. You know, beforehand, you go in a sort of a chariot and the wheel would break. The roads were terrible. The Romans actually made very good roads. They're well known for roads." "Yeah, okay, fair enough. But what have the Romans ever done for us except roads?" "Oh, law and order. On a Saturday night, you can go down a dark street without getting robbed. Oh, yeah, fair enough. Law and order. What have they done for us other than law and order and roads?" "Oh, sanitation and water. They have these great aqueducts." "Yeah, what they..." And in the end, to cut the story short, they said, "Yeah, but what have the Romans ever done for us? Except education, good economy, roads, good health. Nothing, nothing. Out with the Romans." And sometimes we always like finding fault because anger gives us a strong sense of self. It's an ego thing. We feel we've got a cause, we actually exist. Something to work for and fight for. Which is one of the reasons why people with really good causes, whether it's saving the environment, having good governance, you know, being kind to one another, getting some of the problems, you know, in our world with migrants not being looked after, people not being allowed to express their gender preference. All those things that some of these are great causes, but sometimes people get so angry. Why do they do that? Because they feel they're alive and they exist for the time being. We often find when you get angry, you get that high of anger, but afterwards you get depressed afterwards. You lose energy. It's what we call in Buddhism, you're borrowing energy. You have to pay it back afterwards. And it doesn't achieve anything, because if you do get angry, all that people see is your anger. They don't see the cause, the legitimate cause you're fighting for. They just see you're an angry person. So I've never seen anger be productive at all. Even there's many things that I can understand why people are angry, but it doesn't really work. Often cite Mahatma Gandhi. Never got angry at the British. But that one person, simple, without violence, was probably the only way could kick the British Raj with all their power, all of their resources, out of India. Not through violence, not through anger, but through other means. That's an amazing thing that man did. Inspired, led, no anger, no violence. And at that time, they're probably the most powerful empire in the world. Just walked out. Brilliant. Anyway, so, 9 o'clock. Yeah, oh yes.
Only if there's time. Thank you so much for your talk tonight, Arjun. You always seem to speak about something that I need to hear every time. And tonight really hit me because the addiction I realise in my life isn't a physical thing. It's not like a drug or alcohol or anything like that. But it's when it comes to people, you know, things that in terms of things that when you're involved with someone, the good things happen, but also there's a lot of hurt and guilt and things like that. So there's an emotional layer involved with an addiction. And you know deep down that the right thing is to let go, but it's hard when there's good things attached to the bad things that are attached, if that makes sense. So there's no question, but it's maybe you can form a question out of that.
Yeah, indeed. No, I understand that. It was some years ago. I met one of the, I think it was the mother of one of the Claremont serial killer victims. Apparently they're having a trial now of the suspect. But at the time, I gave a talk on grief and loss. And after my presentation, she came up to me, nose to nose. I'd never seen anyone so angry. "How dare you take away my grief?" And that's what she said, and it really rocked me, because obviously I'd given her a path, a doorway, to let go of her grief. But that's who she was. That opened the door to a lot of compassion and kindness, invited to conferences. She became the person, the grieving mother of one of these young women who disappeared tragically from the Bayview Terrace in Claremont. That gave her an identity, and she did not want to give that up. So sometimes the anger is like who we relate to. The grief, sometimes we don't know how to exist without that grief. That's why sometimes it's great to be courageous. Try it out. See what it's like to be someone, even for a day, who has no grief, no anger. After a while, you kind of like it. And you realize you don't have to be the angry person, the grieving mother. You don't have to be the guilty person. We all do errors sometimes. And sometimes in some things, one thing I remember, you know, may not believe this, but when I was young, I had a big motorbike, long hair. Who would recognize me? And I just remember just going down Notting Hill in London, you know, keeping the speed limit 30 miles per hour. It was a wet day, it was a hill. And somebody walked out onto the pedestrian crossing. The car in front of me braked very quickly. I braked too. There must have been some oil on the road, went into a skid. And my bike was heading for the back of the car, still at quite a speed. And I realized that, you know, I had a choice to go into the back of the car, and don't know how many injuries I would get, or actually swerve around the car. I could still do a swerve and risk hitting the pedestrian on the crossing and going to jail for manslaughter or something, I don't know. And as it was, it was a split decision. You know, sometimes I don't know what I'd do again, but I swerved around the car and risked hitting the pedestrian instead of sacrificing my own life. Split decision. Unfortunately, I missed the pedestrian. Not by much, but I missed. It was on a pedestrian crossing. So easy it could have turned out bad. And I could have gone to jail for killing a pedestrian on a pedestrian crossing. I don't know. I remember afterwards I stopped that bike and I just was sweating and perspiring, and took me a long time to get my act together to go home. How many times what you did, it could have turned out so many different ways. So it's very hard to judge anyone, and don't judge yourself either. So you're lucky, I was lucky. Some people aren't lucky. Okay, very good. Hope that sort of answers anyway. Okay, so now we can pay respects to the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha if you wish. Not obligatory, but it's good exercise. That's one of the reasons I always say why monks bow a lot, why Buddhists bow a lot. It's good exercise for the tummy muscles so you don't get so fat, only it doesn't work for me. Arahang Sama Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivademi Suvakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namassami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sangho Namami.